to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Tegan Marshall, from Vancouver Island University, here with two other Vancouver Island University colleagues, Brandon Brownlee and Aaron Wang. Welcome back to Existentialism, the series where we strive to find meaning through the study of existentialism. This is the final part. This gets us to the crux of what we've been working towards. And for those of you who have joined us throughout this series, that question has been, in the pursuit of meaning and purpose, does the existentialist actually get too caught up in abstraction to be present in the moments that matter, primarily those of interpersonal relationships? With that in mind, who are we looking at today? We're looking at Hugh Laffalette's view on personal relationships. And so my colleagues have been given specific reading materials. But what I want to focus on today is, again, going back to his definition of the three types of relationship, talking about his contrast of rigid and historical relationship, and utilizing that in a final kind of general summation of all that we've discussed up to this point, to leave room for some discussion on whether existentialism actually helps us be in the moment or actually takes us away as we strive to pull meaning and purpose from those moments. So are you ready, gentlemen? Your death approaches you out of the future. Now we run to meet it. All right. So Hugh Laffalette wrote his book, Love More... Aaron, what's the title of the book again?
So the work we are discussing today is Hugh Laffalette's Personal Relationships, subtitle, Love, Identity, and Morality.
Thank you. As you can tell, my being got ensnared in something else temporarily, so that's why we have colleagues to draw me back into the current world we're exploring. But in this book, he goes on the mission to help the reader, from a philosophical standpoint, understand the difference in relationship, how we maintain relationships, and what it actually means just to be, well, moral and loving, and I would argue, effective partners in relationship. So, with that in mind, the three of our beings are about to embark on this, so let's get right into it. But before that, gentlemen, do you have any questions, comments, or observations?
So I do have some starting observations, mainly that when I was going through this book, I was actually a little bit surprised because I'm used to philosophy being something that's highly theoretical, highly academic, and I was pleasantly surprised because this book actually had a lot of psychology in it. It's a really good work that combines elements of psychology and philosophy together in just a really interesting way, especially the sections on emotions and then how he ties in on the different ways different thinkers have thought about emotions, how that understanding of emotions applies to personal relationships and human relationships in general. Yeah, I was actually very impressed by this work, so I just like to start by saying that.
Nice. What about you, Brandon?
Yeah, it's a surprisingly readable, accessible text. It's psychological without being overly psychologizing. It does what good existentialism does, which is it doesn't get too abstract. It deals with, it's not phenomenology per se, so it's not really going to the things themselves, though it does rely on a lot of phenomenological evidence, you know, kind of intuitive, like, well, this doesn't do justice to our experience of our emotions or love or anything like that. And he kind of uses that as a guidepost to evaluate previous theories and to moderate and temper his own theories. So I think it's, and I've already kind of mentioned, he's not writing from an existentialist perspective, but his groundedness makes him very conducive of an existentialist reading, and especially his idea of a kind of moderate behaviorism grounded in embodied experience makes it very conducive of an existentialist reading, which I found was interesting. You spend a lot of time in philosophy reading these texts, and when you can find a new reading in that way, a kind of way to cross-pollinate a text, it's very exciting.
I love what both of you guys are saying. It's an accessible reading. It's not widely, you know, big academic words, but it still doesn't mince words in the process. It gets the point across clearly and concisely. What really stood out for me in the text was the amount of just sheer thought examples he uses. He uses people and he uses situations that they're in to really set up his experience and how to navigate those very moral situations, like what it means to be in relationship, what it means to be in personal relationship, particularly, as we'll get to in a little bit here, the rigid versus historical relationships. What is the difference? It doesn't make it necessarily any less of a relationship, but the dynamic is different. I think that you've caught on to something, whereas a lot of, and Aaron as well, a lot of philosophical texts work in the abstract. La Follette, partially because of his mission, is like, I can't afford to do that. So he uses very embodied, very, very in, very just direct ground contact examples versus saying, imagine this. No, he's like, there's these two people, they relate in this way, this is what it makes it out to be. And so I think those are good starting observations, and I think that will get us to the last quarter of the show eventually to talk about what difference that makes as we go back and we look at all the other sources we've looked at. Because phenomenology is great. I enjoy phenomenology, but sometimes it is hard to explain the phenomenon you're observing. For example, my disability experience, I can articulate certain aspects of that. I can articulate the emotions, the relational difficulties of that, but I can't make you actually understand what it truly is like in an authentic way, because you're not me in a historically embodied context. And this is important because Hugh La Follette uses the term historically embodied fundamentally in every aspect of his discussion of relationships. Personal relationships are what makes the world go round. You can have personal relationships with a coworker, which you carpool with. You talk about the sports game. Maybe you talk about work. Maybe you even talk about the children you have, and you talk about how they're doing. But it doesn't really extend much beyond that. It's just kind of a relationship of situation or convenience. Whereas Hugh Laffalette really hammers down on the close personal relationship. A close personal relationship being, as we've talked about before, in a Buber sense, Martin Buber's philosophy, where two beings are in relation to each other. That there's two individuals that choose to invest in getting to know and doing life together. And so Hugh Laffalette describes that, but he also says that can take shape. You can have close personal relationships in two forms. One form is higher than the other. You can have close personal relationships that are rigid, and you can have close personal relationships that are historical. The rigid relationships you may have are relationships with your siblings or your parents. You have a relationship with them because they are related to you, not necessarily because you actively chose to be in relationship with it. But nevertheless, as Hugh Laffalette writes, you want a relationship with your brother because he's your brother. That's why you want it. You want it because you're related, and that's one of the closest relationships biologically to you. So you would want to entertain that. However, we most often think of close personal relationships as those that Laffalette refers to as historical. Historical meaning there's a story to that relationship. There's a story that's been built by both parties. For example, I can say that all my colleagues here have a historical relationship with me, in the sense that we have actively set aside time to get to know each other, to invest in each other philosophically. And so we have context, we have a history to fall back on that allows us to have a deep personal relationship. Whereas in non-close personal relationships, you don't have that history. You don't have that history necessarily you don't have a history that is intentional. That's the big difference. 'Cause you can have a history with, let's say, your favorite grocery store clerk. You go to them every week without fail because they give you the discounts or whatever. Or they just bag your eggs properly. But the reality is, you may know their name, but you know nothing about them aside from that. But for Aaron and I, for example, we know a little too much about each other because we hang out too often. But because of that, that allows us to have deeper conversations, to have a deeper understanding of what each of our worlds look like and how each of our experiences are actually dynamically changing the nature of that relationship. And so it is my speculation, and I have to phrase it that way for just good scholarship reasons. It is my speculation that, at least in my life, there's been a lot of relationships that I have had that are relationships of necessity, that are formed out of a need that I have, needing to be met. One of the things that I started to think about was whether you could call those an actual historical relationship or whether those were more rigid. And I would say it depends upon the nature of how you pursue that relationship. Because obviously, every relationship you're going to have in the world begins somewhat rigidly. It begins with a very defined purpose. It begins because you enjoy how that person smiles, how that person laughs, what stories they have to tell. But as you spend more time, you start to realize there's something more to them than just the traits that they possess. And Hugh La Follette makes a big deal of that. And so I have a question for my colleagues. And this would also be where they could jump in with comments. But what is an example, and you can change names and situations, that's fine. But what is an example in your life where you've seen a rigid relationship go to more of a historical relationship?
I think the common experience for university students is when you are assigned a group project and you're assigned a team, and then you actually end up liking some of the people who you work with on the team and have some conversations with them, like, outside of the project. I think that's a really good example of, like, when you start with that rigid setting of, like, okay, I'm working with you because I have to work with you, and then it gets a little bit more personal. It gets like, oh, I'm talking to you because I like talking to you, and that's fun, and we're not talking about anything related to class, but, you know, we just enjoy talking to each other.
I guess I'm having a little trouble answering the question, just because I feel like that's more of a transition from something like an impersonal relationship to a personal relationship. So, like, you know, let's run with your example. I think it's a really good one, Aaron. You know, I'm in a class, you're a student, I'm a student. Okay. Like, we both have these titles that kind of rigidify who we are, crystallize us into just these titles. But then they loosen up and then they become more developed. I think that's more a transition from impersonal to personal relations. And I say that because I feel like that there's a kind of implicit rubric to the rigid and historical distinction. So with a rigid relation, but La Follette is saying, look, there's a dichotomy you can draw down the line here. You can have rigid versus historical. That kind of implies that a rigid relationship is a bit ahistorical. And I think about, for example, two brothers, and they say to each other, you know, we're brothers forever. There is a sort of eternal quality to that that is immune to historical development. They are brothers forever. You'll always be this or that to me. And I also think about, if we look on the other side, the historical relation, if we're dichotomizing rigid relations and historical relations, there's something always non-rigid or something always fluid about a historical relation. You know, you might be this to me right now, but we could develop into something else. Who you are might change, and that would change the relationship. So I guess I'm having a hard time seeing a transition from one to the other, because I kind of right. see them as mutually exclusive.
And I think you brought up a point that Hugh La Follette also addresses, that historical relationships are in a constant state of flux, that depending on how people respond, a historical can go to a rigid and a rigid can become historical. Let's use a fictional name like Hector. If Hector and I have a historical relationship, we've met somewhere, we spent time together, hanging out, whatever, and we've shared stories and we've come to a deeper understanding of each other. If Hector and I start pursuing different interests, that relationship has one of two options. Either it just vanishes altogether because we're no longer investing, or Or it becomes rigid because we only talk about certain things because now we're two different people, and so there's no longer this sharing of each other, story wise, experience wise, and this is Hugh Lafalette's whole purpose, is to make the reader question. What relationships are you more involved in? Are you choosing people for who they are and what they've been through, as he would say, for who they are as a historically embodied creature? Or are you choosing them strictly because they're your brother and so you do that? They're a definite thing and you choose them because they're that, without choosing to actually invest more intentionality into the relationship to discover who they are as a historically embodied creature. And I think this is a good question for existentialists to consider. You mean I can actually actively think of myself as a creature that is within the limits of time and space, and that matters? Versus no shade on Heidegger. You know that I'm a diehard Heideggerian. Dasein is aware of temporality, but Dasein is far more of an abstraction. You can't feel and see your Dasein. Your Dasein just is. And so I was like, wait, you mean I can be a historically embodied creature in this line of thought? Nice. Because that makes a lot more just experiential sense, that you understand, okay, who you are today is a direct result of who, you know, who you've been through the history of your life, and that you get to then step forward with all that and make new inroads through relationships.
I was really impressed with chapter 2 on emotions, and this is something that I I'm not familiar with, but there's actually a lot of people who have put forward various theories on what emotions are, philosophical theories and psychological theories, and what their relationship is to the human experience. I found this like really, really fascinating because it was arranged logically, but also with a lot of examples, so you could tell exactly what he was speaking of. So he, just to get into a few of these details, I have some notes. Emotions typically find objects within a person about another person. Knowing the object of an emotion empowers us to reasonably predict how we will act in the future. I don't know if one of my colleagues wants to try to give an example of that, or if I should just move on to some more definitions.
Of knowing the attribute that causes an emotional response within a future to predict the future response. Well, I mean, that makes sense, right? If, because it's similar to Lafalette talking about the characteristics that you are drawn to in relationship. So if, for example, on an emotional level, if you find someone who is compassionate and maybe that is something that you are intrigued by, you want to see that more in action, and that causes a emotion of wonderment for you, for example, or joy to see that in action, you are naturally going to gravitate towards people with that. And so if you find a person and you actually do the introspective work to say, how does this make me feel? It's not unrealistic to suggest that the next time you observe that, you're going to respond the same way because you've set up a precedent within yourself.
And for the sake of clarity, what I'm reading here in my notes are, as much as possible, direct quotations from Chapter 2 of Hugh Lafalette's work. They're not my own words, for the sake of our audience listening and for the sake of clarity. So I have a few more quotations that I think are kind of helpful for setting this up. So each emotion is an evaluation, which usually causes one or more desires which lead to behavior, while the evaluations and wants together cause abnormal psychophysiological changes and the subjective registering of feelings. So not to go too deep into this, he mentions some cognitive theorists who say these evaluations are the core of emotions. In paradigm case evaluations, and I'm quoting again here, they cause physiological processes we introspectively feel, and two, cause us to act in characteristic ways, which we talked about a little bit already. He moves on to say, recognizing the centrality of evaluations reveals one way to control emotions. Recognizing the centrality of evaluations reveals one way to control emotions. Although emotions are not standardly under our direct control, we cannot merely will them to change. We can sometimes change them by changing our evaluations. Understanding this way to alter emotions can be put to good use in our personal relationships.
That makes sense to me because that's something that I've had to do in my personal life in moments of challenge or in moments of struggling with some of the challenges that I have to try and look at the things that are invoking emotional responses and to say, okay, how can I actually change the stimulus so that it changes the emotional response that I then exhibit? Sometimes it's easier said than done, but that makes sense to me on a practical level.
Which, according to La Follette, is essentially the behaviorist idea of studying, which he says is critical, of critical importance, and he says some people dismiss the work of the behaviorists too easily in his work. And I'm not saying that is correct, but that is his view, which we are considering.
Right, yep.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that La Follette does with the emotions is, and this is a product of, well, it's one of the main reasons he kind of rekindles the behaviorist camp of psychology, is it makes emotions public. If emotions have to do with behavior, then we can finally get around this weird question of, well, how do people learn their emotions? Because if under the usual view, emotions are just purely internal, purely mental, there's a real gap about, well, how do we learn about emotions? You know, there's an abyss between people's mental and phenomenological experience. But if emotions are public, if they're exhibited in behavior, in the ways we act, our tone and whatnot, the objects of what we're reacting to, there's a very concrete and apparent way in which emotions are learned, because it's just anything that is public can be publicly observed and habits can form around that. And I find that that he takes the sort of Wittgensteinian line very interesting and illuminating. Emotions are one of those things where we really are, as a kind of culture, we're very caught up in our metaphysical baggage. And so any kind of reminder like this is always very illuminating, even if you know, because it's in the background, we always slip back into the baggage. You come back to the Wittgensteinian or the La Folletian line, it's like, oh man, it just makes so much sense.
La Follette literally calls it Cartesian and Freudian baggage.
Hi, I'm Tegan Marshall. You're listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. We're just about to transition to the second half of our show on Hugh La Follette and existentialism, personal relationships, and all the other facets of whether existentialism spends too much time in abstraction that you miss the moment, or we focus too much on the moment that you miss the whole picture. Personal relationships are